Well, I suspect we've all had times in our lives when we've just felt that everything is turned against us, when we felt under siege. Perhaps work is particularly tough. Perhaps those persistent sins seem to be driving at us harder than they normally do. Maybe sickness or injury befalls us or a family member, and our plans for the next few months or maybe even longer are just thrown into chaos. And we don't know where we're going. Maybe that colleague, that family member who takes particular exception to you being a Christian is just digging in every time you see them with snarky comments and just belittling you every time you encounter them. All these things that go on. And I suspect if I were to speak to or ask some of you who are have perhaps been around for a little longer than I have, I would find out that actually these instances don't lessen as we go on, but they keep coming and perhaps even get more serious. Times when we're under siege, when we're under pressure. And all we really want to know in those times, or all I would want to know anyway, is, well, when is this going to stop? When can I find some just rest and peace and not have this pressure around me? Well, during the time in Isaiah's life that we're reading about tonight, God's people in Judah, I think, were very much going through one of those times. They were surrounded by hostile nations on all sides. They had Moab and Edom to the east, Philistia to the west, Tyre to the north, Egypt to the south. Israel, the northern kingdom itself, had given in, had fallen and become a vassal state of the Assyrian Empire. They had become a threat themselves on the northern empire, and Assyria was pressing in. They were now a small kingdom, an isolated kingdom, and it probably would have felt that there was only a matter of time before Judah would suffer that fate as well, and therefore they would be conquered, before they would lose their nation. And maybe on a night like tonight, when there aren't so many of us around, it's maybe easier to have that mindset of being a small group of people. We may be feeling the pressure of being surrounded by hostile nations all around. And probably the question they were asking was, when would there be peace from this? When would their enemies finally leave off? When would they finally be defeated? When would there be peace and rest? We're picking up in Isaiah 13 tonight. And the next chunk of Isaiah, we find a series of prophecies of judgments given by God on the nations that surrounded Judah. And so we get prophecies against all of those neighboring countries. So Moab and Edom, Philistia, Tyre, Egypt, Assyria. And the first one we'll get tonight will be Babylon. And what these are proclamations from God. So if you just look at the verse 1 of chapter 13, this is a prophecy against Babylon that Isaiah, son of Amoz, saw. So these are visions that he is given of what is going to happen. So these are kind of God's pictures of what will happen to the nations around them. And maybe unlike lots of threatenings of judgment we read in the Bible, given to other nations, these are not warnings to them, but they are judgments. Probably none of these prophecies would ever have been heard in the nations that they were given about. These weren't calls for the nations to repent, to turn away from their evil ways, but they were judgments from God that they would suffer defeat and destruction. And these were given particularly for God's people to hear. So they were given to the people of Judah. So why would they need to hear about the judgment that was going to befall their neighbours? Well, I think there are a couple of reasons. One was, well, they've had warnings of judgment themselves. And that first chunk of Isaiah that, I'm not sure how many months ago now that we were looking at, there was a mix of promises for the future that God would still save a remnant, but there was judgment as well, that they had wandered away, that they were not serving God as they should. They were making light of the temple. And so, just as they were facing judgment, well, they get the measure of reassurance that God isn't ignoring the sin that's happening around them either. God will not ignore the sin of the nations, of the way that they treat the poor and the weak, of the way that they would enslave people. God would judge the nations around them as well. God was not just a God of a single place. He was a God of the whole earth. And I think the other reason that God forewarned them about all this was that, so as time passed and they saw the nations around them fall and be taken over, that they wouldn't mistake this for just kind of an act of the fates or the kind of schemings of humans. That they would know, they would be able to look back and see, oh, God told us that that would happen. This wasn't just what happens to nations. This was God behind these actions. And so they would know when they saw the events of history unravel or unroll before them that God was in charge, that he was sovereign. And so we get these judgments on the nations. But mixed in, we will also see promises of rest for God's people. So the two big points that we'll cover as we go through, we'll see that God is in charge over the nations. He will hold them to account and he will judge them. And that God's promise of rest for his people still stands. There is still a promise for rest for them. God has not forgotten them and he will still look after them. We're not going to read through the whole of the two chapters. We're going to do a chunk from the beginning of chapter 13 and then a chunk from halfway through 14 just to get a flavour of what these judgments were. So we'll start at chapter 13 and we'll read the first 11 verses. A prophecy against Babylon that Isaiah, son of Amoz, saw. Raise a banner on a bare hilltop, shout to them, beckon to them to enter the gates of the nobles. I have commanded those I have prepared for battle. I have summoned my warriors to carry out my wrath, those who rejoice in my triumph. Like a noise on the mountains, like that of a great multitude, listen, an uproar among the kingdoms, like nations massing together. The Lord Almighty is mustering an army for war. They come from faraway lands, from the ends of the heavens, the Lord and his weapons of his wrath, to destroy the whole country. Wail, for the day of the Lord is near. It will come like destruction from the Almighty. Because of this, all hands will go limp. Every heart will melt with fear. Terror will seize them and pain and anguish will grip them. They will writhe like a woman in labor. They will look aghast at each other, their faces aflame. See, the day of the Lord is coming, a cruel day with wrath and fierce anger, to make the land desolate and destroy the sinners within it. The stars of heaven and their constellations will not show their light. The rising sun will be darkened and the moon will not give its light. I will punish the world for its evil, the wicked for their sins. I will put an end to the arrogant, to the haughty, and will humble the pride of the ruthless. And then turn over from chapter 14, verse 22. I will rise up against them, declares the Lord Almighty. I will wipe out Babylon's name and survivors, her offspring and descendants, declares the Lord. I will turn her into a place for owls and into swampland. I will sweep her with a broom of destruction, declares the Lord Almighty. The Lord Almighty has sworn, surely as I have planned, so it will be, and as I have purposed, so it will happen. I will crush the Assyrian in my land. On my mountains I will trample him down. His yoke will be taken from my people and his burden removed from their shoulders. This is the plan determined for the whole world, and this is the hand stretched out over all nations. For the Lord Almighty has purposed, and who can thwart him? His hand is stretched out, and who can turn it back? This prophecy came in the year King Ahaz died. Do not rejoice, all you Philistines, that the rod that struck you is broken. From the root of that snake will spring up a viper. Its fruit will be a darting, venomous serpent.
The poorest of the poor will find pasture, and the needy will lie down in safety. But your roots I will destroy by famine. It will slay your survivors. Wail, you gates, howl, you city, melt away, all you Philistines. A cloud of smoke comes from the north, and there is not a straggler in its ranks. What answer then shall be given to the envoys of the nations? The Lord has established Zion, and in her his afflicted people will find refuge.
So the picture we get at the start of chapter 13 is of Babylon being swept away by a massive army that was being brought together by God. He was rising a banner on a hilltop. People were coming from the ends of the earth. A mighty army was being mustered. And they would sweep in and they would destroy Babylon itself, a great conquering nation who had swept others away. They themselves would suffer that same fate. And their destruction would be terrible and it would be complete. So verse 6, wail, for the day of the Lord is near. It will come like destruction from the Almighty. Hands will go limp, every heart will melt in fear. Terror will seize the people. This is going to be a terrible judgment that is coming. And there is going to be nowhere to escape from it. Wrath and anger. It will destroy the very land and everyone in it. And so Babylon faced the threat of destruction. And what would happen here is the army sweeping in. It's not in the sense of kind of an army directly controlled by God. We're not talking about kind of an army that would bear the banner of God and declare that they were coming in the name of God to wipe out God's enemies. This would be a number of nations that would come in and have their own agenda. They would be probably seeking only their own power and only their own rule. But nonetheless, says Isaiah, this would be a mustering of an army that God had called. They might have their own plans, but they were moving at God's instigation. He was the one who had brought everything together. And so, as we picked up in chapter 14, verse 22, that it is just as if God had destroyed them themselves. I will rise up against them, declares the Lord Almighty. I will wipe out Babylon's name and survivors. Well, they may be facing destruction at the hands of another nation, but there would be no accident here. This was God's hand at work. And it is just as surely as if he had destroyed them himself. Babylon would be destroyed. They would be swept away and nothing would be left. That was the threat. Or that was the prophecy of what would happen. And not just them. Assyria would fall as well. 25. So chapter 14, verse 25. So I will crush Assyria in my land. On the mountain I will trample him. His yoke will be taken from my people and his burden removed from their shoulders. Assyria would also be crushed. God had spoken. No one could thwart him because he was the one who ruled over all of the nations. He's the one who stretched his hands over all the nations. And just for good measure, Philistia, or the Philistines, well, don't you get comfy just because someone who is opposed to you has fallen recently. You too will come under judgments. You won't escape. You will face destruction. Your very city gates will wail and cry out. They will melt away as if destroyed. God was going to judge and destroy all of those three nations that were around. And the language that's used is harsh and terrible. There would be no hope. There would be nowhere to escape. But actually, the language used, although the prophecy is given against Babylon and then the Philistines and Assyria in the middle, the language used often spreads much wider than them, doesn't it?
So if you look at 13 verse 11, he's not punishing Babylon there. I will punish the world for its evil and the wicked for their sins. I will put an end to the arrogance of the haughty and humble the pride of the ruthless. Although the prophecy is given at Babylon, the focus seems to be much wider every now and again. And when we look at some of the language used, look back again at verse 10, well, the stars of heaven and the constellations will not show their lights. The rising sun will be darkened. The moon will not give its light. Well, actually, that's the kind of language that we're more used to seeing in the Gospels or in Revelation, talking about the day that Christ will return. When stars and constellations will be darkened, where the sun will be put out, when there will be great darkness and terror on the land when Christ comes back to judge. So although Isaiah is talking about these nations that are there and here and now, well, actually, the visions that he sees apply much wider. There's an implied judgment on the whole world of all sin and evil everywhere, and something much more final than just the destruction of Babylon. We don't really expect that the fall of a single nation would be accompanied by stars in the heavens going dark. Well, there's something much bigger going on here, isn't there? Well, the way that helps me to think about this is when Isaiah is seeing these prophecies that are given by God, it's kind of as if you're looking through a telescope the wrong way round. As everything gets kind of pushed really small, your depth perception just gets pushed out. Everything looks flat and pushed together. And so when Isaiah sees these prophecies, sees these visions of judgment that would come on the land, well, he sees them all together, and so that's how he reports them. But actually, the dimension of time has kind of been squashed out there. And so we get this mix of, well, the fall of Babylon right now by an invading army, and judgment against the whole world, and something that looks much more like a final judgment, where God would finally come, the final day of the Lord, where all of the world would face destruction and darkness, and he would come to judge everyone finally. And Isaiah just sees all of this and records it flattened down without that time dimension. And so what we see is things that God will definitely do, but we don't see so much of clues as when he will do them. So we have this mix of God will judge and destroy all of the nations, not just Babylon and the Philistines and Assyria. And there will be this final day of the Lord. But we don't know when it will be. But we do know it will come. Those certainties of these are the things that God has decided and no one can stand against them, they still stand firm. So Isaiah's focus is on what God will do, not so much on when he will do it. Now, there's something that strikes me as odd about the ordering of these prophecies. Because at the time, there is Judah, and its main threat up to the north is Assyria. They're the invading country that's engulfed Israel. They're the ones who are pushing in. And actually, Babylon isn't even an independent nation. It's kind of a province within Assyria at the moment. It would be 150 years or so before Babylon would rise and take down the Assyrians. So if I were writing prophecies of reassurance, I'd go, right, here's your biggest threat. They're not going to stay around very much. So we'll start with Assyria. Assyria are going to fall. But Assyria barely get a mention. There's only a few verses, just a mention in passing. Assyria will be destroyed. Isaiah starts with Babylon. So why does he start there? With this nation that wouldn't even rise for 150 years. Why all of the focus? Well, let's take a bit more of a look about what he says about us, what he says about Babylon. Turn over to chapter 14 and verse 11. This is part of God's judgment and verdict on what would happen to Babylon. So from verse 11 it says, "All your pomp has been brought down to the grave. along with the noise of your harps. Maggots are spread out beneath you, and worms cover you. How you have fallen from heaven, morning star, son of the dawn. You've been cast down to earth, you who once laid low the nations. You said in your heart, I will ascend to the heavens, I will raise my throne above the stars of God. I will sit enthroned on the Mount of Assembly, at the utmost heights of Mount Zaphon. I will ascend above the tops of the clouds. I will make myself like the Most High. But you are brought down to the realm of the dead, to the depths of the pit. Now, when we get that little middle section of what Babylon has said about itself, I will ascend to the heavens, I will raise my throne above the stars of God, I can't help feeling that it's just a little bit over the top. It's probably not what a single person at any point would say. It has that slight flavour of a Bond-style villain. You can almost imagine it. It's kind of scripted with rubbing hands together in a maniacal laugh. I will sit enthroned on the Mount of Assembly. I will raise my on the utmost heights of Mount Zaphon. There's this kind of megalomania in there. And I think that's perfectly intentional. Because what Isaiah is doing when he talks about Babylon is encapsulating in them this whole attitude of placing ourselves in God's place, of making ourselves the greatest thing that is around, of raising ourselves up as much as we can, of that arrogance and pomp that is mentioned at the beginning being destroyed. So Babylon is there not just representing that nation that would come and would be the threat to Judah, but Babylon is also that picture of all nations that would try and make these claims, that would place themselves above everyone around them, who would seek to exalt themselves above all of the gods of the world. And actually, isn't that the same thing that has been happening since humanity fell? That arrogance, that wanting to displace God and put ourselves in his place. Well, that's just the very essence of human pride, isn't it? Our desire to be like God. You think right back to the fall in the garden. Well, the promise that enticed Adam and Eve to take the apple was, you will be like God. Could well have been, I will raise my thrones above the stars of God, isn't it? I will put myself where God is. Or we think at the Tower of Babel, when humanity came together, come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower with its top in the heavens and let us make a name for ourselves. Well, what was the attitude? Oh, let us raise ourselves up to the heavens, raise ourselves up to God's place. Just the same way as that attitude that Babylon is portrayed as having in Isaiah. So Babylon isn't just referring to that one nation that would come in history, and in time it would fall and be destroyed. But it's more of a type of all of the nations who would have that attitude. Or nations, or militant organizations, political parties, groups of people. Or of the attitude that exists in the human heart itself. It's why we find the name Babylon taken up again in the book of Revelation, where we see pictures of the final day of the Lord, where the stars would darken, where he would judge the entire world. So Revelation 18:2 says, fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great. Babylon is portrayed as this great nation who had enticed the nations around her into sin. It says, in her was the blood of the prophets and the saints. She declared that she was a queen who would never see mourning. This attitude of arrogance, of placing themselves above and in God's place. And so, from the time of Isaiah, in fact, from the very time of Adam and Eve's fall, through to the very end of the age where God would finally judge everything once and for all, Babylons will continue to come and go. None of them will be permanent, for God's judgment always comes on those who would put themselves in that place. There will always be that charge of how you have fallen. But they will keep coming. There will always be groups of people who would want to persecute God's people, who would want to exalt themselves, who would want to exalt maybe human reason or our own independence, deny the fact that we are creatures dependent on God. We can decide for ourselves what is to come in the future. We can have control over all of creation up to and beyond the heavens. And so this attitude, this picture, will keep coming. So Isaiah sees not just a picture of one nation in time, but the pattern of nations that would come, of groups of people that would come again and again until the very end. And so that means that we shouldn't expect to see a complete fulfillment of what Isaiah has prophesied here. We do see that Babylon did fall in the end, into various degrees and at various times. But we shouldn't expect to see all of what Isaiah has said to have already happened. Some of it will apply to what will happen only in the future, only when the final day of judgment comes. So as well as judgment on the nations, God also promises rest for his people. We get this kind of middle bit right at the beginning of chapter 14, where he diverts away from proclaiming judgment on what would happen to Babylon, and he switches to what would happen to his people. So have a look from 13, verse 1. The Lord will have compassion on Jacob. Once again, he will choose Israel and will settle them in their own land. Foreigners will join them, and they will and unite with the descendants of Jacob. Nations will take them and bring them to their own place. And Israel will take possession of the nations and make them male and female servants in the Lord's hand. They will make captives of their captors, and they will rule over their oppressors. On the day that the Lord gives you relief from your suffering and turmoil, and from the harsh labors forced upon you, you will take up this taunt against the king of Babylon. How the oppressor has come to an end, how his fury has ended. The Lord has broken the rod of the wicked, the scepter of rulers, which in anger struck down the peoples with unceasing blows, and in a fury subdued the nations with a relentless aggression. All the lands are at rest and peace. They break out into singing. And then turn over the page to the very end of chapter 14, where we get a tiny bit more, which we'll come to in a moment. This question that gets asked, the army coming in from the north, not a straggler amongst their ranks, so organized, fast, efficient. Well, what answer shall be given to the envoys of the nations? The Lord has established Zion, and in her his afflicted people will find refuge. So in that bit of chapter 14, we get a pause from those prophecies of destruction to remind God's people that he still has a purpose for them, that he has not forgotten them, and he will keep his promises. We get this beautiful reversal. So their position at the moment is they are losing their land. They are at threat as nations come in, that they will lose the land that God has promised them. And so, once again, he will choose Israel and will settle them in their own land. God will keep that promise of a land for his people, of God's people living in God's place. And there is rest. Looking down at verse 7. So all the lands are at rest and peace, breaking into singing. And there's this wonderful reversal of God's people who have been captives, who have been enslaved by the nations. Well, they will become captors themselves. Nations will come to them. They will be joined with other nations, and they will make captives of their captors. They will rule over their oppressors. So God will bring not just judgment on the nations around not just judgment on those surrounding nations, but he would still bring this promise of peace and rest and of a land for his people to live in. There will be relief. There will be an end to the pressure and the siege that they are under. But we've mentioned already that Isaiah's prophecies don't give us much of a clue in terms of time of when they're happening. And there's a problem with this bit at the beginning of chapter 14 is that that didn't happen. There were partial returns. So after the exile, a number of God's people did come back. The temple was rebuilt. But there was never a time when Israel would be free from the rule of another nation. There was never a time when they wouldn't have been captive to some degree. And they were passed along from rule of one nation to another. Fulfillment of this promise hasn't yet come. But what is our message from Isaiah? Well, it's not concerned with what God, the timing of when God will do things, but he is declaring what God will do. And so this then is a future promise. There will be God's people living in God's place, free from the rule of anyone else. There will be peace and rest. But we're not going to find it in a physical Israel on earth with God's with people living there. It was going to take a different shape. We know that the promise of living with God comes now to us through Christ. That promise that he would go and prepare a place for us and that we would be able to live with God there. That's the shape that this promise of rest and of a place, of a land, of living with God will take. It is a future promise that we will finally see fulfilled when Christ returns, when final judgment comes on the world. And so we have this dilemma, don't we? We know that God will judge all who are haughty, all who would persecute his people, all who would place themselves in where God would stand. But we know the final judgment of that isn't going to come. Not while the earth still stands, at any rate. We're going to continue to see people who rise themselves up, who persecute God's people. This is a pattern that is going to repeat through time. And the promise of that final rest and of that final land, living with God in his place, also isn't going to come until Christ returns. It's a future promise. And so we're left in a place where, well, we're going to continue living in a world where persecution and affliction and that sense of being under siege will come again and again. Nothing will last indefinitely because God judges the arrogant and those who oppose him. Nothing stands forever in the face of God. But until his final judgment, until Christ's return, this pattern will keep repeating. We'll find ourselves looking forward, longing for that land that God has promised. Facing these Babylons that will keep cropping up. So how do we stand in the light of those struggles? As we continue to face off against the world, the flesh, and the devil until that time comes. Well, that's what the end of chapter 14 was for. Well, what shall the answer be given then to the envoys of the nations? When more people, when another threat sweeps in from the north, where there's another threatening army. Well, the answer that will be given is this. The Lord has established Zion. And in her, his afflicted people will find refuge. Well, Zion is the city of God, another name for Jerusalem. And it was special because it was the place of the temple. It was the place where God would dwell with his people. And that was the place that would be refuge. Isaiah tells us a little bit more about it in Isaiah chapter 28. This is Isaiah 28 verse 16. So this is what the Sovereign Lord says. See, I lay a stone in Zion, a tested stone, a precious cornerstone for a sure foundation. The one who relies on it will never be stricken with panic. Now, we have the advantage of looking backwards in time, and so we know what Isaiah is referring to with this cornerstone, don't we? This cornerstone who is Jesus. Acts chapter 4, verse 11, or from verse 11 says this. This is Peter when he was standing before the high priestly council. This Jesus is the stone that was rejected by you, the builders, which has now become the cornerstone. And there is salvation in no one else. For there is no other name under heaven given among men by which he must be saved. Or what would be the hope for God's people? Well, it would be the cornerstone in Zion. It would be the place where God dwelt with man. And where does God dwell more perfectly with man than in the person of Christ? God and man dwelling together perfectly. He is to be our firm foundation. The one who we can flee to and find refuge and then never be stricken with panic, in which we would find salvation. The way to living as God's people in his land. So, affliction and hard times and that sense of siege and everything coming against us is going to continue. These things will go in cycles and will come round again and again. But we have a place in the meantime to go for refuge, don't we? We have Christ, the cornerstone, God and man dwelling together. And by relying on him, we will find refuge. By relying on him, we can stand against that siege. And by relying on him, we have the promise of a home in God's place and of that rest from all of our enemies fulfilled. That is where God's people go in that meantime, while we wait for Christ's final return and the fulfillment of all these things. We rest in him. We keep our eyes fixed on him.